Although the president declared an open-ended global war on terror and compared the struggle to the great wars of the previous century, he studiously refrained from asking his fellow citizens to contribute to the war effort. This is Bacevich again, not me. Instead, he promised tax cuts and encouraged them to go to Disney World. When it came to implementing his freedom agenda, Bush seemingly expected his existing army to suffice. Who needed a levée en masse when you had shock and awe? Now, if this is not criticism enough, other observers have been even less kind to President Bush. Thus, while recognising that there were ideological elements in the equation, they argued that these only operated at a secondary level and indeed could not be taken seriously. Less favourable to Napoleon, they were by extension inclined to see the war in Iraq as an exercise in imperialism. Let us here quote a journalist writing a review of Goya's Disasters of War, the famous engravings that Goya produces after the end of the Peninsular War, of various scenes from the conflict. And this is what the journalist said. "Beneath any comparison lies the hard truth that the arrogance of power breeds stupidity. Napoleon may have deluded himself into believing that his brutal subjugation of a rival empire was an act of deliverance from a hated despot. Just as Bush could have bought his own PR that his Middle East power grab would somehow carry with it the seeds of democracy. Both used the facade of the Enlightenment, however faded and debased, as a cover for their wanton acts of aggression." Equally scathing, meanwhile, was an article that appeared some 2 years earlier in the American Conservative, which is a very right-wing review. It's one of the interesting things about the opposition to the Iraq War is it does not split American politics in terms of left and right. You'll actually find people on both sides of the divide supporting the war and opposing the war. Anyway, and this is it's a very, very conservative American review. Anyway, the article is the work not of a historian or a political commentator, but rather of an evolutionary biologist named Gregory Cochran. Evolutionary biologists, because of ideas of Darwinianism and so forth, are very often interested in the idea of conflict between races, between states, and so forth. Anyway, this is what he says. "The two countries' high cash flow made them tempting targets. Napoleon certainly expected to get a lot of revenue from Spain. And although the US government denies it, I have to think that we would have had trouble staying interested in Iraq if it had had nothing but sand. However, the most detailed piece of work on the manner in which imperialistic parallels can be drawn between Bush and Napoleon comes from an article penned by a historian and political analyst called Juan Cole. Now, Cole, it is possibly Cole, I think he's of Cuban origin, but I don't know how Americanized, so to speak, his name is, but we will call him Juan Cole. Cole is an expert in Middle Eastern history and culture who is bitterly opposed to American policy with respect to Israel and the Arab world. Incidentally, when I say he's of Cuban origin, and he born and grew up in the United States, he was in effect an American citizen. So this is not the product of Cuban communism. Anyway, his blog, which is called Informed Comment, is probably the best informed and most articulate of all the many voices in America that have condemned the war in Iraq. And if any of you are interested in matters Middle Eastern in general, whether it's Iraq, Israel, whatever, do consult Informed Comment. It is absolutely extraordinarily interesting, well-informed, informative, and so forth. Wonderful source. Anyway, with extraordinary serendipity, Cole found himself writing, in the middle of writing, a book on Napoleon's invasion of Egypt in 1798. As the coalition rumbled into action in the Gulf. And as might be expected, the tone of his remarks is extremely bitter. There are many eerily familiar resonances between the two misadventures, not least among them that both began with supreme arrogance and ended as fiascos. Above all, the leaders of both occupations employed the same basic political vocabulary and rhetorical flimflammery, invoking the spirit of liberty, security, and democracy, while largely ignoring the substance of these concepts. The French general and the American president do not much resemble one another, except perhaps in the way the prospect of conquest in the Middle East appears to have put fire in their veins. For both Bush and Bonaparte, the genteel diction of liberation, rights and prosperity served to obscure or justify a major invasion and occupation of a Middle Eastern land, involving the unleashing of slaughter against its people. Gone then is any pretense, the argument, that Napoleon and Bush were anything other than imperialists. But as imperialists, they did share a common view of their prey. Both wars, writes Cochrane, started under the influence of similar delusions. Thus, in both instances, one has the commander-in-chief of mighty military machines convinced, rightly in each case, that the conventional armed forces that could be deployed against them were incapable of withstanding an invasion. And, much less correctly, that victory in battle would be followed by total submission. This being an expectation fueled by a failure to perceive that in Spain, as much as in Iraq, the central government was not the central factor, if you want, in popular loyalties. In Spain, so it was claimed, what mattered was the province. Excuse me. And in Iraq, the tribe and or religious / ethnic community. At all events, in neither case did peace follow war. In Spain, as much as Iraq, the result, quote unquote, was a tiresome guerrilla war. We thus return to the position enunciated by Lutwak and Bacevich. But here, Cochrane is far more subtle in that whilst he admits that much of the local religious leadership sought to whip up hatred of the invaders. The chief stress is rather placed on economic issues. There were many young Spaniards, he says, with idle hands in 1808. Much of the economy was generally depressed because of the economic warfare between Britain and France. Iraq is like that, only more so. There was hardly any Iraqi economy at all during the 1990s, thanks to sanctions. In other words, people can be whipped up into a crusading fervour if they have no other means of survival, if they have no other means of providing for themselves, if the gun is what buys them food. There is then some disagreement as to the origins of popular resistance in Spain. But insofar as what followed is concerned, there is general agreement that the parallels between what happened in Spain and Iraq were very strong. Given the strong impact of his contribution to the historiography of the Napoleonic era, you might here cite the American cultural historian David Bell. To grasp the essence of the conflict, we need look little further than the uncannily similar situations that have unfolded in Iraq after the American victory in 2003. American and Allied forces engaged in a protracted, frustrating attempt to move Iraq towards peace and stability. And a part of the Iraqi population, led by the titular government, sided with them. Another part, probably larger, remained aloof, focusing principally on its own safety and well-being. A third part viewed the foreign forces with open hostility, while a fourth part, probably quite small, engaged in active resistance. Since these insurgents had no chance of successfully confronting the enemy in pitched battles, they instead engaged in sneak attacks on small detachments or on civilians, after which they immediately melted back into the population at large. Their actions made it impossible for Americans to leave heavily fortified bases, except in heavily fortified convoys. American soldiers complained in private about being unable to secure any territory other than that beyond the immediate range of their guns. Now, I again skip over a little bit here to make up a little bit of time, but if we want to reinforce that point, all you have to do is to go and read some of the many, many French memoirs that we have from the Peninsular War. And you don't have to worry about reading French to do that. You can read some of them in English, published in translation. And they, in many instances, say things which are very, very redolent of the passage that we've just heard. They talk about French troops not controlling any more land than the land which they physically occupied. They talk about it being incredibly dangerous for French soldiers to wander out of sight of their own sentry positions. They talk about themselves being utterly isolated and friendless in this incredibly hostile, dangerous environment. Now, as far as critics of the war were concerned, of course, the point of all this discussion of the Peninsular War was to prove that Bush had led the United States and her allies into a war which they could not possibly win. A war which had seriously damaged Washington's international credit, and which might even lead, ultimately, to the downfall of America as a world power. Yet all along, a number of problems dogged this hypothesis.